You seated, everyone? Okay. Good morning again. This is the second case to be heard by the Nevada Court of Appeals. I'm joined today by Judge Jerome Tao, Department 3 of the court, and Judge Abby Silver. Excuse me. She's Department 3. Judge Tao's Department 1. Thank you all for being here, and any guests that are here, too, in the audience. The next case to be heard is number 62792, Tony Sanders and Robert Sanders against Risa Sears Page. That was the matter that was heard in Clark County District Court with a jury trial and a personal injury action, and the jury returned a verdict in favor of the defendant. For the appeal here today, we have arguing for the appellant, Mr. Signor. Okay. And is anybody else with you? You're all by yourself.
I'm all by myself.
Okay. We'd like to have everyone introduced that's involved in it. And then Mr. Winter's here, and you have someone else with you today.
Yes, if the court please, Thomas Winter and Andrew Smith are here for the appellant.
All right. All right, Mr. Smith, thank you for coming in, too. All right, we'll start with the appellant's case. If you want to reserve any time for rebuttal, please advise the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to spend seven going through the issues as quickly as I can because there are so many. And this is a matter of housekeeping. Do I call you Your Honors, Justices?
Okay. Your Excellency, Your Majesty.
That will help my cause.
Judge is fine. Thank or you. Your Honor, either way.
Well, Judge Silver, Judge Givens, and Judge Tao, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I want you to know this case arises out of an automobile accident for negligence that happened back in May of 2009. There are six issues here. I'm going to go through them quickly because there are so many that I don't want to use up my time over explaining them, but I will be hopefully answering questions at the end of the during the 8 minute rebuttal period.
Just to warn you, we've looked at this carefully already, and one concern we do have is regarding the juror that was not replaced, and that is a significant issue because we don't have clear law in Nevada on what happens after a jury is seated and a juror has a question that comes up, whether there might be some sort of conflict with that juror. So because it's somewhat of a new area, we're particularly interested in that point.
That's the first issue I want to talk about, Your Honor. That particular issue is number one. I have six of these issues. The issue about juror number nine not being excused from service is not necessarily what we think is the most important issue in the case, but is the one we start our brief with. And that case, when you look at the totality of the questions that were asked by the court, the lawyers involved, and the fact that not only was he a juror that had treated with the same facility, but had made a decision to go beyond that facility's recommendation and get a second opinion, and then didn't follow that facility that the plaintiff treated at, physician's advice, but followed a separate physician's advice, I think was probably the main thing that made it difficult for him to be unbiased. Again, his comments were, they speak for themselves, and they're in the brief, and I'll go through them in rebuttal. The second issue that I wanted to talk about quickly is...
Can we go back to that first issue?
We can, if I'm going to...
I'd like to. In cases such as Prasado, the Nevada Supreme Court has refused to overturn a verdict, even where the district court errs in failing to strike a juror for cause because the party could nevertheless utilize a peremptory challenge. And how does this analysis change, whereas here you obviously could not use a peremptory challenge?
How would you change
the analysis because there is no case law on this?
That's interesting you bring that up because one of the issues that I think... will be argued by the defense that there is no damage here. The problem is in this case, when the juror informs the court, after questions not only by the court, defensor, and the plaintiff lawyer, that he's treated with this particular doctor that is the same facility and doctor that treated my client, there's no opportunity for us to go in and say, you know what, we don't like the fact that this guy's on the jury, we're just going to exercise one of our peremptory challenge. The argument that the defense makes is that this should be some sort of heightened standard, and they use 16.080. as their argument. I think that if anything, it should be the reverse of that. Again, when you say there's no case law, the case law that we cite in our reply brief indicates that the Nevada Supreme Court has utilized 16.050 in its evaluation of jurors who do come up with issues following impoundment. And so I think in this instance, certainly the standard that's used in Hoodire should be the standard. If anything, I would argue, because of the significance of the influence and the fact that a juror feels it compelled to come forward and say, oh, by the way, we have this problem. And then when you look at this particular case and the way that they questioned him and the equivocal nature in which he answered those questions, I think that it was mandatory and incumbent upon the judge to excuse that juror at that point.
Well, every a challenge for cause and questioning by the court involves, by definition, findings of fact by the judge as to whether someone can or cannot serve for various reasons. And as you know, on appeal, we have to defer to the district court's findings of fact. So what is it that you think was clearly erroneous or an abuse of discretion in this case in particular?
Well, the standard that's applied is one that shows that there is an unequivocal expression and lack of bias by the prospective, or in this case, the impaneled juror. And when you review the record and the answers given, and the repeated answers given, they're not unequivocal, they're equivocal. He makes comments, I think so, okay? He says, I'm leaning towards. I know the defense comes in and says, you know, let's just put those sentences together. But if you look at the plain language of what the questions and answers were, he's already making decisions, he's already leaning towards in a way that we think biases. I mean, think about this, Your Honor. This juror treated with the same facility that my client treated with, it went out and got a second opinion, didn't do what the doctor that the facility that my client treated with suggested that he do. All those are going to, you know, give you a bias towards not listening to, and plus it feeds right into the arguments that were made that relate to the misconduct. As it, in hindsight, this judge actually decided to remove a juror because he thought that there was some sleeping going on. I don't know if that you remember that in the index in the record, but when he looks over and he sees a juror who seems to be not paying attention, allegedly dozing off for a minute, he asks the question, were you sleeping? The initial answer is no. And he presses her. And finally, after he says, look, you're under oath now, I mean, come on, you know, tell me, you know. I would argue that that juror probably wasn't sleeping, probably wasn't super thrilled to be sitting there listening to Dr. Du. But he immediately removes her. And I thought, you know, if he applied that same standard to this juror, he would immediately remove this juror also.
Mr. Signore, what about once the judge did the questioning of that juror? The juror's sitting there by himself, the other jurors are excused, in the jury box. We actually got the JAVS recording so we could see how that questioning went. Now, the other one you talked about with the juror falling asleep, we won't be able to see that because the camera doesn't focus on the juror. But at any rate, how does it feel as a trial counsel to have the judge ask you if there are any challenges for cause while the juror is sitting there and then plaintiff's counsel says, yes, we challenge for cause? The defense counsel said no, plaintiff's counsel said yes, and then the judge says, oh, Mr. Jones, you better be excused and wait outside while we discuss this.
Well, given the outcome, it doesn't make me feel very good. That's your question. I want the judge to do everything they can to make sure that I have a fair shot here. And given what this juror said, and given what this juror's, to me, obvious disposition is regarding the treatment and the potential evidence, that, a lot of evidence had already come in, they should excuse this juror.
Does it matter, should it matter, or do you know of any cases that say it matters, that it was an 8-0 verdict?
Say it again, I'm sorry, my ears are still...
8-0 verdict.
Does it matter, do you know any cases that say it matters, that the final lineup for the jury was 8-0?
If anything, I don't have any cases, obviously, otherwise I would have cited them in my reply brief and my opening brief, and I didn't look at it from that perspective. I don't think it really matters from an evaluation standpoint. I would argue, though, however, that an 8-0 verdict shows the influence that potentially was affected by the juror number 9 who eventually became the foreman. And so when you have an 8-0 verdict, and just to put in context what happened here, and I'm over my 7 minutes, I hope you give me an opportunity to rebut. This case was a 5-day trial. It lasted until 11 o'clock at night on Friday. There was a juror that had to go to work at 1 o'clock in the morning. The jury had come to the judge and said, you know, can we just let her go and use an alternate while we finish deliberation? And, of course, the answer was no, and he kept him there forever. And so it's not an appealable issue, but I think it gives you a context of what's going on in this courtroom and the desire to get this thing done and get it done quickly. And the juror who's in charge of the jury happens to be juror number 9, who's indicated that, hey, I think I can be unbiased, and although I'm leaning in a certain direction, I don't think it's going to hurt you, Mr. Winter, for the defense, if that's your question. I'm leaning already a certain way. And then later on, they combine those two sentences and try to argue, well, can we interpret it the other way? And I go, well, if there's a question of such import before the court, then excuse the jury and use an alternate. It's that simple. Right. Even when they excuse this other juror for allegedly sleeping, the defense lawyer, Mr. Winter, says, well, we can put her in as an alternate, or we can cure it by reading back what you think may have been testimony she missed of Dr. Duke. But none of that was entertained. It was like, no, get rid of her. And I thought, man, if you'd only been in the same mindset with this juror, I don't think there would have been any question, but I think it was a different day, a different time, a different phase of this trial. So,
Mr. Signore, you said you had 6 issues. Obviously, it won't be time to cover those. So whatever you believe is the next most significant issue, we should turn to that. And I'm going to interrupt you here for a second and give you a little more time because we had some students came in today, and hopefully that didn't interrupt your train of thought when they came in.
It's going to give me more time. I think it really interrupted my train of thought.
Well, we had a lot of students here today, and welcome to all of you in the courtroom. This is the very first time the Nevada Court of Appeals has met in a courtroom, so you're part of an historic event. Unfortunately, this courtroom is not designed the way a trial court is, and there are not enough seats for everyone. So if counsel had no objection, I see there are 6 chairs, that might be 7 chairs available. If we can pull those chairs back against the bar where they are, and 7 students can come up and sit in the front, and then you'll really be part of this historic event.
And Your Honor, may I ask what school they're from?
Okay, do we have a teacher or leader here today?
We're from
Leanne Zanello. Okay. I only asked because my youngest did the same thing.
Okay. All right, there is one extra chair over here that you could pull it back towards the there. Yes. Okay. Now, I would invite 4 of you to come up and join us here on the bench, but that might be going too far.
They wouldn't mind me, Your Honor, especially if you let them make a decision.
After the proceedings, then, we'll talk about that. All right, so you get an extra 2 minutes for this little interruption here. Do you want to go to your next most significant issue?
Your Honor, one of the things I wanted to point out is that I didn't look at these issues as 1 through 6, being the number 1, the most important, number 6, the least important. I looked at these issues as all important, some a little weightier than others, but they certainly, in their aggregate or in their overall view as they fit together, warrant a remand. The issue that I want to jump to then, given the time constraints, is the issue regarding this exhibit number 62 that was brought in. That one, despite the court's impression that the juror issue is very important because of the case law that appears to be inadequate from the court's view, that issue to me is just such a clear one. This record comes into play, arguably it's not even relevant because it doesn't reference in the chief complaints anything to do with the real issue in the case, and that's whether or not she had neck problems.
Well, why is this exhibit so significant? If this is exhibit 62, obviously there are a lot of exhibits, and normally a trial court's decision on admission of evidence is discretionary and won't be overturned unless it's a clear abuse of discretion and it affected the outcome of the proceeding.
I think the reason it's significant is when you look at the reply and you look at Dr. Duke's testimony, he is relentless in sticking to his guns. You could put a purple piece of paper in front of him, he'd still say it's black and white. And he relies on nothing in the record, which bleeds into one of our other arguments, to formulate his opinions. Nothing in the records indicate that she had prior back complaints leading up to a few years before this incident. And so he latches on to that despite the representations that, hey, we're just going to show him this and ask him questions. At the beginning of this, they were entertaining the idea of having him testify about it but not entering it into evidence. And that would have probably solve some of the problems, but they entered it into evidence. He looked at it, and they relied on it, and he states very clearly when he's pressed under cross-examination, did she treat for neck pain, despite the fact that the record says her chief complaint and only complaint that she goes to the doctor for is shortness of breath, and he notes that she has a cholesterol problem with Dr. Pollard. And then Dr. Pollard, being a osteopathic slash chiropractic type doctor, recommends neck, mid-back, and low-back manipulation. They never just manipulate one part. They usually do the entire spine.
And that was the first day you saw that document.
Absolutely. And that's without anything that has to do with the authenticity of it, Your Honor. I appreciate that comment, Judge Silver. It's a document that should have come in just for relevant reasons that don't have anything to do with anything. And then Duke, under cross-examination, says, my opinion is right there. She treated for neck problems. And it's right there in black and white. I go, no, it is not. It's completely controverted by that evidence. And there was no other evidence that indicated prior neck treatment or complaints. And so that should not have come in. It was just plain error. To me, it was one of the stronger issues in the case. In addition to that, it comes in on the fifth day of trial, on a five-day trial. It comes in under the guise of somebody who has been threatened under court punishment, sanctions of some sort. It's dropped off to Mr. Winner's paralegal in a box. Mr. Winner has a chance to go through the box and pick out one piece of paper that he decides he likes, and then he presents it to the court, and the court says, I don't see a problem with it. And the authenticity issue is just completely ignored. I mean, they talk about it, sort of. They try to argue that my client authenticated it. We focus on that in our brief really thoroughly. With that, though, I want to sit down because I want to be able to rebut.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank
you very much, Mr. Sigmore. Mr. Leonard, Mr. Sigmore talked about a few anecdotes about what happened during the trial. It sounded like it was all in the record, but I'm not certain that was all in the record.
I'm not sure that was. I agree.
So you'll be given some similar liberty to describe things because that helps bring the case to life to us, but try to confine yourself to what's actually in the record.
I guess I should say, because it was brought up so recently in Mr. Siegmiller's argument, while it's fresh in your mind, Exhibit 62.
Go ahead and start with your argument then.
Thank you. Exhibit 62 was delivered to my paralegal and delivered to the court. There is something in the record about Mr. Anderson's representations and my representations, excuse me, to Judge Baer, saying we've been trying to get these records for a long time. We knew the records were incomplete. We have prescription records showing she was getting prescriptions. We don't have the records of the prescriptions. There are a lot of records missing. I threatened the custodian from the facility, from Dr. Pollard's facility. I'm going to ask for a contempt citation if you don't bring me the records. We've subpoenaed these records repeatedly, and finally, in the middle of trial, the records were delivered. I had never seen them before. Mr. Anderson said he had never seen them before. Of course, I believe him. Judge Baer gave us some time for both of us to go through the records, and we did that. He said, in fairness, let's take a recess and let you both look at these. I didn't even have a chance to go through all of them. I picked out a couple of records and said, I think this is relevant, and I'd like Dr. Duke to talk about this, and Judge Baer allowed me.
Well, how would you feel if the opposite happened? A box of records just dropped off in the middle of the trial, in the middle of the trial, and, I mean, you're on the web. For all the district court judges to see your response to if that happened to defense in the middle of trial. A medical record purportedly...
How would I feel?
Well, I mean, that's why we have a discovery commissioner. This is why we have discovery deadlines. And that's a whole other, the authenticity is a whole other issue. But
I think
this is a civil case with certain, you know, with an RCP. How do you reconcile documents in the middle of trial being entered to the jury? And not only that, your expert testifying, because I was only a district court judge 2 months ago, and I recall a lot of motion limines from yourself and other defense counsel regarding district court judges limiting the testimony of experts, retained experts, as to what is already in their disclosures and their reports. How do you reconcile what happened here?
I think that's a great question, and I would like to talk about that. Bear in mind that Exhibit 62 concerned the plaintiff's prior medical history, of which she claimed to, the evidence seemed to suggest she had a limited recollection of her medical history. She just simply didn't remember her medical history very well. This plaintiff had just been on the stand swearing before God and this jury that she had not had any neck pain since 2004, had not had any neck pain since 2004, and she swore that her low back pain began in 2008. She withdrew her claim for low back surgery at the start of trial, so it was only a neck surgery she was claiming. She had chronic low back pain, well established in recent records, and she said, my low back pain began in 2008. I had a brief incident of neck pain in 2004 with a bone spur, and my neck didn't bother me again until after this car accident. That was demonstrably untrue. Her prescription records indicated she was getting pain pill prescriptions in 2004, in 2005, in 2006, in 2007, in 2008. She swore under oath her back pain began in 2008, so my question to her was, why were you getting these pain pill prescriptions? And she said, well, it must have been for my back pain. The back pain that she swore she didn't have yet until 2008. I didn't get a chance to go through all of those records, but it was simply, the suggestion was clearly made to the jury that she might have been filling those pain pill prescriptions. She hadn't been filling them for something, and her memory seems to be a little faulty. And here was a 2005 record where she had a pain pill prescription, and included in those complaints was neck pain. I would also say,
couldn't that have been used to impeach her during her testimony?
Yeah, so we did try to impeach her, and she essentially said, no, I don't think I saw the doctor for that. The record said something else.
So you're okay, then, in the middle of trial, getting these types of documents?
I'm often not, but bear in mind, this is, my job as a defendant isn't to uncover falsehoods that the plaintiff might present accidentally or intentionally. That's not my job. However, these records concern the plaintiff's own medical history. This is information that should have been available to her and in her own memory.
Why didn't you do a motion to compel in front of the discovery commissioner?
Good question, but I don't know that it was a discovery.
If you send a subpoena and you're not responding to the subpoena and you're getting up to that discovery deadline, why would you not just make a motion to compel in front of one of our discovery commissioners to get that information?
That's a good question. However, what I did do is identified the custodian of records of that clinic as a witness at trial. We subpoenaed that custodian of records to appear at trial, and we want all of your records. And there was some threat by my office to them. We know you haven't given us the records. If you don't bring us all of the records, I'll seek a contempt citation. And lo and behold, during trial, sorry, here are all the records.
But you didn't do that before the discovery cutoff.
No, I did not. But
was there any suggestion the plaintiff was involved in the withholding of the records?
I would never suggest that. No, I don't believe that. I think the doctor was overworked and sloppy and maybe a little lazy and just didn't give us the records. But I would never accuse, I've known Mr. Siegmiller for years, I would never think such a thing, and I would not suggest that to the district court or to you.
So the Exhibit 62...
I would say the same to me.
All right, good. I'm glad to hear that. Exhibit 62, was it actually used during the questioning of Ms. Sanders?
She was recalled to the stand, and I asked, as I recall, she was recalled to the stand, and she was shown that record, and she said she disagreed with it.
I'd like to ask about Mr. Jones's statement where he stated, I know which way I'm leaning. It suggests that he disagrees with the plaintiff's choices because when faced with a similar situation, he made a different choice. And his statements to the district court occurred after your opening statements in which you told the jury essentially that the Nevada Spine Clinic doctors sold Ms. Sanders her surgery that she didn't need. That said, looking at the totality of everything of the testimony, questions and answers from Jerry Lamar and Mr. Jones, does it show an implied bias sufficient to require striking the juror pursuant to Prosado? And how can we be sure that this possible implied bias did not infect the jury's verdict as he ended up being the foreman?
Well, there are
Several questions in that.
And I'm going to argue this kind of in reverse. No, I don't think it demonstrates an implied bias. He reassured the court over and over again, reassured me over and over again, that he did do some research into his own back condition when he was treating for that years ago, when he was recommended for surgery. He did research into his own back condition, not the plaintiff's back condition. But he said that evidence is evidence, and my experience with Dr. Guman will not affect my evaluation of this case. Had that been raised during jury selection, I would have objected to a challenge for cause. I would have. I didn't think cause was there. I don't think there was bias. I don't think there was implied bias. Maybe that's up in the air. What's, I think, crucial here, though, is we can't even get to that point. We can't get to that point because this is a jury that had already been impaneled. He's sitting on the jury.
Which is part is one half of Prasado case. I mean, this is an impaneled juror. The second part is the analysis of, you know, whether or not that possible bias could have infected the jury verdict, and we have an 8-0 and he's the foreman. How can we be sure as the Court of Appeals that his experience with Nevada Spine Clinic and those doctors, which he chose to disregard and do something else, he's already impaneled. How can we be sure that that didn't affect the rest of the jury in the verdict?
The extent you can be sure of anything, he was asked that question. And we believe under the analysis of the appropriate statute under an impaneled jury, he can be removed really only if he's not capable of serving as a juror on the case. I think it's a different standard striking a juror before the jury is impaneled. Bear in mind,
do you have a case for that?
So,
different standard for the pre?
We have the two statutes, 16050 and 16080. Judge Gibbons, your question, I think, suggests a public policy that I think this court needs to affirm and embrace, and that is once a jury is sitting and has been impaneled, what is to stop some lawyer from saying, this juror keeps rolling his eyes at me and folding his arms. I don't like the way this trial is going. Your Honor, I think this juror has prejudged this case, and I'm going to question him about what he thinks of this case during day three of trial. That should never, never be permitted.
Well, when the challenge for cause was made, your response, in part, was to suggest to the judge that they make him an alternate. Now, some could construe that as kind of a non-opposition to the challenge. What's your response to that?
As I recall, I suggested they make an alternate of the juror that was sleeping, but I might be misremembering. I think that was Mr. Siegmiller's point, I think.
The objection was raised, the juror was still sitting there. So that's the first issue. The juror's in the jury box, and this is being discussed in front of the juror, or whether he should be excused. And then it goes on to, you don't object, plaintiff does object, then you're asked for your response. I think the juror was out of the room before you gave your response. And you said, well, he makes a good point, but I still believe that juror can stay. And then there's a little discussion with the judge, and then it goes on, but judge, you might make him an alternate. And then later on, the judge comes back to it and says, are you serious about that suggestion to make an alternate? If you are, I have to rule on it. And you said, no. The judge said, is it brainstorming? And you said, yeah, it's brainstorming. So you never actually made a motion.
I was thinking on the fly, and I didn't even think about the distinction between 16050 and 16080. But I have seen situations where a lawyer in a case will say, this lawyer is making faces at me, he keeps folding his arms, I don't like the way he's looking at me, I'm afraid he's prejudged this case, I want to stop and voir dire this sitting juror.
That's really different than the facts here, where the juror actually went to the same doctors in the same clinic and we're talking completely different, somebody holding their arms or rolling their arms.
And in this case, it was the juror who brought it to the attention of the court. He wanted to talk to the judge and say, hey, there was something that I didn't mention because I didn't know about it the first day. So it's not just some lawyer doing it as a tactical thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I agree with both of you, but consider the reason why. He was not asked those questions during jury selection. Ask him, have you ever done any research into your own low back condition? Have you ever visited Dr. Kovkin? Have you ever visited Dr. Gooman? Ask him that when we're picking a jury, while we're picking a jury. Not on day four of trial because somebody forgot to ask him and he says, does anybody care that I went to Dr. Gooman? Because I did. And the judge allowed some questioning to see if he was capable of going forward. The judge was satisfied he was capable of going forward, and he stayed on the panel. But none of those questions were asked him at the time when it was appropriate to ask him.
Who had the burden to bring up those topics during the jury selection?
I don't know that that's a good question. I don't know that either side had the burden to bring those topics up. He did talk about...
You could be in front of some judges that don't even allow jury questions, which I'm aware of.
Well, this judge did. All of those jurors were questioned about their past experiences. We were aware that he had back pain in the past. We were aware that he was diagnosed with problems in his low back. He was asked questions about that. He was not asked if he'd ever been a patient of the Nevada Spine Clinic or Dr. Gooman. He was not asked. I didn't ask him. Counsel didn't ask him. And then whatever day down the road of trial, after witnesses have already been called and he's been sitting there listening to testimony, I didn't realize you were a patient of Dr. Gooman. Let me ask you about that now. I would suggest that there's a reason there is a distinction between 050 and 080, and this is the reason.
I was curious. After these questions came up, nobody asked the juror, well, what do you think of this doctor? Is he a good doctor? Do you like him? Is he good advice? Did you have a question to doubt his advice? Why did you talk to somebody else? And when did you finally make the decision that you weren't going to have surgery? And I mean, just kind of feel it out to see what he really thought, because the judge presented as either side might object to this person. We don't know what he thinks about the spine clinic. He didn't say. He just said he'd been there.
That's true. I asked him, would anything about your experiences with Dr. Gooman cause you to have any feelings in this case that might favor the plaintiff or favor the defendant? And I said, you know, we'll present some testimony that's critical of Dr. Gooman's clinic. Are you going to be able to set your experiences aside and just judge this case based on the evidence? And he said, yes, he would. I think Judge Silver's questions are excellent questions, but there was an opportunity to question this juror during jury selection. There was an opportunity to ask him if he had researched his prior low back problems. There was an opportunity to ask him if he had been to Dr. Gooman. And that opportunity was there before that jury was impaneled. And to take that opportunity after some days of trial, after the jury has been impaneled, and then say, well, wait, we think he might be biased. We're not sure that we think he might be biased, and we should get a cause challenge that we didn't exercise during jury selection because we never asked him that. I think that's
opening. Judges, are there any other questions for Mr. Winner? All right, Mr. Winner, thank you very much for the excellent presentation.
Thank you. I managed to reach one issue, but thank you very much.
Well, we talked about two. We talked about Exhibit 62 and the juror not being stricken, and those were the main areas we asked. Also to Mr. Sigmiller. All right, so Mr. Sigmiller, you've reserved some time for rebuttal. It's just over 3.5 minutes, but remember, you're not supposed to bring up new topics, even though you had 6 issues you wanted to talk about.
Well, I'm not going to blame anybody but myself for not getting to all 6 of them. Your Honor, I did want to address a couple of things. I think that one of the distinctions that was pointed out by Your Honors in the questioning of Mr. Winner is that the juror in this case was not asked a specific question about his prior treatment and who the physicians were. And I think what's important is when you think about the opportunities to ask questions, judges ask questions, Judge Silver is absolutely correct. There seems to be a rush to get juries selected often in trials. This is a 5-day trial that lasts 11 o'clock at night. That is in the record, by the way, in the index. And it's a case where when you look at this particular juror, and he's listening to the opening statements, and he's listening to the name of the clinic, but not specifically the doctor. He doesn't hear that specific name. Eventually, he comes to this opportunity in his mind that I got to tell him that I went to this clinic and saw this doctor. It was eating on him, in my opinion. When you look at the reference to the actual questioning, Mr. Winter does, in fact, offer to make this juror an alternate. He did exactly the same thing in the index as it related to the sleeping juror. I think an understanding that he knew that there's potential for a problem here down the road if, in fact, they sat on the actual jury. The motion in limine, I think, was also a very good point that was discussed during Mr. Winter's testimony. It was a motion that was submitted by Mr. Winter. It was a motion to exclude any new evidence about medical treatment, and it was obviously violated, and that was part of our argument. I think for the totality of the arguments that we've made, the important issue, as we've discussed them on these two issues for me, is that to try to come up with a higher or stricter standard for a juror who's been impaneled, who on his own volition decides that it's important enough to raise the issue with the court, and then as Judge Tao pointed out very clearly, sits there and listens to Mr. Anderson object to this juror. I mean, typically what happens when you use a peremptory challenge or an objection for cause, you sneak up to the bench. The judge hushes you if you talk a little too loud.
Well, the counter-argument to that is that's what we do now as a matter of practicality, but the old-school method back in the 50s and 60s, was everything was done out in the open. Challenges, all that stuff was done in the open. So if you're going to say that by law we're going to say you can't do it in front of the juror, we've just overturned 200 years of how things were done before any of the three of us got under the bench.
Well, I'd say 70s, 80s, and 90s, too, by the way.
I haven't been around for 200 years, and I know you haven't, Your Honor. But we did cite a 1901 case in our brief. But I think what's important, and I think that, you look at all these issues, but to stick to these two issues, the courts are constantly refining the issues and the conduct and the way that we proceed in order to make the proceeding fair. So to go back and say, well, 200 years ago we used to do all kinds of things that we don't do now, why isn't it okay still? I would say, if that were the standard, I think it's pretty obvious I'm not an appellate lawyer.
Well, 200 years, the counter-argument
is... approve that probably, but that's not the world we live in. I think what the courts are trying to do is to say, look, we need more civility. Things are starting to change in our society. This juror and these rules need to be followed. And in this case, they were not. They just weren't. And to come up with a standard that says, look, this guy who specifically says he can't unequivocally be unbiased and then exercises influence in a biased way should have been excused, just like the other juror. Thank you, Your Honors.
Just to say that historical, this isn't a question that you need to respond to. It's a historical observation about the 200-year thing. Back in the days of the columnists...
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm sorry. My ears are plugged.
Just as a historical observation, you don't need to respond to that, but just along the lines of talking about history, 200 years ago, your qualification in the time of the columnists, your qualification to be a juror was you had to know something about the case because they lived in small towns and they wanted people who had an opinion about the credibility of their neighbors. And obviously that's not the same, but it's not something that either one of you needs to respond to, just a historical footnote to the historical discussion we just had.
Thank you. Thank you for an excellent job.
Thank you.
This concludes our morning session of the Nevada Court of Appeals. We'll be reconvening at 2 o'clock this afternoon. We have two criminal cases this afternoon.